Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Jim, I just got to run to the restroom before we start.
All right, but can you make it quick? We've got a lot of episodes to record.
Oh, I will. Ready.
All right. Ready for Zevon Day 2, guys?
Yes, but Patrick pissed his pants again.
I always knew he didn't give a damn.
Where we last left off on Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
With us is
Hunter Bennett.
Hey, Hunter. We left off a bit of a cliffhanger with the Warren Zevon story. So we're doing Warren Zevon Week. Warren Zevon is one of our friend Hunter's favorite artists, and he puts so much time and effort into preparing this week for us that
God bless him.
We say no?
Yep.
Come on. Hunter, join us. So where are we going with episode two here on Warren Zevon Week?
Well, episode two is titled The Asylum Years. So as you might infer from the title, we're going to talk about the four albums that Warren Zevon put out on Asylum Records. But before we get to those records, there's a period in which he's not doing much of anything. So let's recap. When we last spoke, a version of one of Warren's songs had been placed on the B-side of the wildly successful Midnight Cowboy soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And another one of his songs was the B-side to the Turtles' mega hit Happy Together. But Warren's solo career wasn't going anywhere. So he takes a job as the piano player slash band leader for the Everly Brothers, which is how he starts hobnobbing with the cream of the crop of L.A. studio musicians, including Waddy Wachtel, who is a short, curly-haired guitar player from Brooklyn. And if you've ever seen the video for Adam Sandler's The Hanukkah Song, Waddy Wachtel is the short dude with the crazy hair that's playing guitar. He played with Linda Ronstadt. Mm-hmm. Like, he played with the cream of the crop of like 1970s LA sort of soft rock bands. So if you keep an eye out in live recordings, he's almost always there. And the dude's a monster guitar player. So, through Waddy and the studio guys, he meets Jackson Brown. Who loves his songs. Brown tries to get him a record contract, but Warren's voice is a deal breaker. So Jackson Brown says, "You know what? I know a great vocal coach that I can hook you up with." So he introduces Warren to this guy who's like part vocal coach, part psychologist, part sadist, who apparently used corporal punishment to get people to sing correctly. And apparently when you were walking by the guy's house, you would hear screams emanating from within as he was trying to help his students sing better. So, but even the sadistic coach can't help Warren. So he records some demos, but they drum up no interest. And finally, he's like, "That's it. I've had it with the music business." And so in 1975, he moves to Sitges. I'm sure I'm butchering that pronunciation, Spain, with his wife, Crystal, who is an aspiring writer. And we'll talk about Crystal again later in the week. So Warren gets a gig in Sitges playing piano in an Irish bar, of course, in Spain, called the Dubliner, because I think every other Irish bar is called the Dubliner.
Yes, that's right.
So the Dubliner is the social hub for expat freaks and hippies, and it's owned by a former mercenary named David Lindell. And during Warren's stint as the piano player at the Dubliner, he and Lindell co-write the song "Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner," which will turn up on Warren's second album. So Warren has a great time playing in Spain. And you know, it's funny, like if you read, and I, before the internet, I read pretty much everything available in print that I could get my hands on about Warren Zevon. And it made it sound like he was in Spain for a really long time. But, you know, and by all accounts, he kind of thought he was. But Crystal says in the book, she thought they were there for a really long time too, but it was like 3 months, maybe 4 months. because one day Warren gets a postcard from Jackson Brown, and the postcard says, "Too soon to give up. Come home. I'll get you a recording contract. Love, Jackson." And so Warren does. He moves back to Los Angeles, and, you know, he ends up getting a deal with Asylum Records, which is David Geffen's label. And it's called Asylum because it's supposed to be a safe haven for true artists. And apparently it was. People really loved being on Asylum Records, and Warren really loved being on it. So this brings us to Warren's first proper album. We talked about Wanted Dead or Alive yesterday, but that's not really. Everybody regards Warren Zevon, the self-titled Asylum record, as his first record, right. His first true album.
Right.
So it's recorded in 1975, and it's released on May 10th, 1976. And, you know, there are a couple of hallmarks of Warren Zevon, and that is, you know, he's known for his smart, funny, autobiographical lyrics. He's known for having famous co-writers on a lot of his songs, and he's known for having a lot of guest stars. And so this record has two of those three hallmarks. There's a star-studded list of musicians who appear on this album. There is Jackson Brown, who also produced the record. He sings harmony, plays piano and guitar on some tracks. Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks, they appear on there. Phil Everly, Bonnie Raitt, J.D. Souther, Don Henley. But we'll get to my favorite cameo in a minute. But, you know, unlike his subsequent albums, on this album, Warren Zevon wrote all the songs. And I believe that's the only one of his albums on which that's true. And the lyrics on this record are fantastic. And they give you a lot of insight into Warren and his life. You know, the song Mama Couldn't Be Persuaded, is about his parents, who we talked about yesterday, Stumpy, the Ukrainian gangster gambler, and his mom, the 20-year-old Mormon. And so I'll read these lyrics because I love them so much. It says, "Gambler tried to be a family man, though it didn't suit his style. He thought he had him a winning combination, so he took us where the stakes were high. Her parents warned her, tried to reason with her, never kept their disappointment hid. They all went to pieces when the bad luck hit. Stuck in the middle, I was the kid." And the last line blows me away because it's so simple, yet it says so much. Like, you know, it pretty much tells you everything you need to know about Warren Zevon.
Yes, for sure.
And I mean, that's you've also got on here The French Inhaler, which is about the disintegration of his marriage to Marilyn Livingston, who he called Tuli. And that's like part Bukowski, part F. Scott Fitzgerald. It starts with, I mean, this is such a great line. "How are you going to make your way in the world when you weren't cut out for working, when your fingers are slender and frail?" And, you know, he talks about how she was going to be an actress, and he, you know, they were going to survive by her being a famous actress. He was going to play his music. And because she was going to be a movie star, he drank up all the money. and then, I mean, then you got Carmelita, you know, talking about being all strung out on heroin on the outskirts of town. Muhammad's Radio, Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me, and Hasten Down the Wind. I mean, all of those songs ended up, they weren't hits for Zevon, but they ended up being huge hits for Linda Ronstadt.
Right,
you know, as we were talking about yesterday, the guy, you know, though he may not have had a tremendous amount of success as a solo artist, as a songwriter, I mean, he really knocked it out of the park. But, you know, I think we're going to try and do one song per album, and the one I would like to focus on here is Desperados Under the Eaves, which is the last song on the record, and it might be my favorite Warren Zevon song, and in fact, it might even be my favorite song ever.
I was sitting in the Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel. I was staring in my empty coffee cup. I was thinking that the gypsy wasn't blind. All the salty margaritas in Los Angeles, I'm gonna drink them up. And if California slides into the ocean, like the mystics and statistics, predict this motel will be standing until I pay my bill. Hey! Don't the sun look angry through the trees? Don't the trees look like crucified thieves? Don't you feel like desperados under the eaves?
That's so great.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there. You know, what I love is it starts with the, strings, which is sort of a nod to those afternoons spent analyzing scores with Stravinsky in Hollywood.
Right.
And then, you know, the narrator, which by all accounts was Zevon himself, is sitting in the Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel, which was a notorious flop house at the corner of Yucca and Grace Streets in Hollywood. It's now a dumpy condo building that I make my kids pose in front of every time we're in Los Angeles. You can like track them, like their childhoods, but like, oh, look.
You've got those height marks actually on the condo, whereas most people have them in their house. Okay. Yeah,
totally. So, and you know, the narrator's staring at his empty coffee cup. He's on a margarita drinking bender, and then he utters, you know, the immortal lines. And if California slides into the ocean, like the mystics and statistics say it will, I predict this motel will be standing until I pay my bill. which is, you know, which is really funny on the one hand, but I think one of the reasons the song resonated with me so much, and, you know, this kind of just occurred to me last night, is like, it's really funny on the one hand, those lyrics, but they also capture alcoholic desperation sort of perfectly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can think of so many days where, you know, I'd wake up and have to sort of piece together what the night before was like. And, you know, the line, like, I predict this motel will be standing until I pay my bill. It's like, there's literally no way out of his predicament. And even if the entire state is destroyed, he's still going to be stuck in that miserable hotel room with himself. And then, you know, then he gets to the, you know, the big chorus, don't the sun look angry through the trees, which is, again, like, it's the California dream. But if you're a broken down alcoholic, like, it's not that at all. It's, you know, it seems like the world's against you. And in fact, he even, you know, when he sings the chorus the second time, he says, don't, or he repeats the line at some point later in the song and just says, don't the sun look angry at me. And I think sort of, between the music and the lyrics, it just sort of perfectly captures just being miserable and feeling like you're stuck somewhere and there's no way out.
It's, yeah, it's the morning. It's the next day. It's the morning. You don't want it. You don't want that experience, right? That's probably the worst time of day for you in that circumstance, right?
Yeah. And what I think too is very interesting about Zevon, especially the early period, being so fascinating to me, is that it wasn't like he, you know, had whatever you want to call failures or not success. I mean, obviously, as we've documented, he had his songs put on two very well-selling records. But it's not what, you know, you would call his control, like all written by him, his destiny, his arrangements, you know, his situation. Yet it wasn't like he forgot that or just got through it or wiped it the slate clean. He always seemed to remember or take the absurdity or the hopelessness from every situation that he was in and document it or somehow remember it and write it down. And I think, you know, that's something that artists can do. You know, like you said, it's not like every night, or even if every night was a single blackout, you know, it's not like he forgot, or when he was piecing those moments together, he was able to recognize the absurdity and the hopelessness at times, or, you know, just the complete ridiculousness of life, and write it down and put it to poetry and make it into art. And that's, I think, the difference between him and many others, at least when you listen to this first album.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he arrived. I guess what I'm trying to say in a long way is not like he arrived completely fully formed out of nowhere. You know,
yeah.
Like he didn't just, you know, descend on a cloud and was this amazing observer of life and poetic detail.
Yeah. And he does such a great job of, I mean, if it were just sort of the desperation,
yeah.
It would get old.
Yeah,
but he does
totally.
Such a great job of leavening it with humor. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the title of the song, Desperados Under the Eaves, you know, the Eagles had that whole sort of 70s outlaw image. Like you look at the cover of the Desperado record and they're all decked out in like leather dusters.
Yeah.
When I hear the song title, I picture them huddled together under like the eaves of a Hollywood bungalow because it's raining and they don't want to ruin their suede and like
right.
leather. And so there's that. But so he's kind of making fun of them, but they also play on the record.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And you know, another great thing, I mentioned the cameos a little bit ago. The line California is sung mm-hmm. by Carl Wilson because they were like, what's more California than the Beach
That's
Boys?
Yeah.
So they brought Carl Wilson in to sing the line California.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I'm looking at the vinyl here too, but, you know, The lyrics were for a very good reason printed on the sleeve. You know, you can sit here and read these things without listening to the music and definitely get something from them.
And I think that was, I mean, you guys, you particularly, Patrick, own far more records than I do. But I, you know, as I recall, like, it was rare for, you know, a major label release to have lyrics printed
totally.
On it in the 70s.
Yep. Absolutely right. Yeah, because it wasn't about that, you know. It was it was about projecting something that was going to get on the radio and letting, you know, sort of people interpret it in their own way. And when you put the lyrics on there, you're definitely, you know, precluding a lot of that, which is very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's, if we can go back now and if we can play, you know, if we can play out sort of the ending of the song, mm-hmm. Where I think if we can start with where he goes back to sitting in the Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel, and sort of play out from there.
I was sitting in the Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel. I was listening to the air conditioner hum. It went.
What I love about that is, like, the last verse, he's right back where he started. He's sitting in the Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel still because he's never getting out of there. But he's not staring into the empty coffee cup anymore. He's listening to the world's most mellifluous air conditioner. And it's just got that great sort of humming thing that then the strings match it. And then, I mean, I just love when the vocal comes in with Look Away Down Gower Avenue, which it's actually Gower Street, but I guess Gower Street didn't have the right number of syllables. And you definitely wouldn't want to sing Look Away Down Yucca Street. So it, but it just, it's so triumphant. I mean, I remember the first time I heard the song. I was in my crappy apartment that was across the street from the Washington Cathedral. And I think I was like lifting weights while playing the song in the next room. And just all of a sudden the outro came on and I was like, oh my God, this is like the greatest thing I think I've ever heard. It's just so triumphant. It's, I love it. What do you guys think?
I'm gaining a completely different perspective on the song.
I know,
by,
I know.
By listening to Hunter talk.
So the debut album, as I think, as Patrick mentioned yesterday, was critically very well received. But alas, it did not get any higher than number 189 on the Billboard charts. So that brings us to album number two, Excitable Boy. Well, I guess as we transition into talking about Excitable Boy, after the first album comes out, Zevon goes on tour. He is in a full-blown alcoholic spiral, but he manages to record the follow-up album, Excitable Boy, which is released on Asylum in 1978. The record is again produced by Jackson Browne, though this time, Waddy Wachtel, the short, guitar virtuoso from Brooklyn is the co-producer. And we've got a host of guest stars again. We've got Carla Bonoff, Mick Fleetwood and John McVie of sort of more Fleetwood Mac and, Linda Ronstadt. And on this record, unlike the first one, Zevon's got a bunch of co-writers. He's got Jackson Browne, who co-wrote Tenderness on the Block, which I've always thought of as sort of a precursor to Somebody's Baby. And then other than Browne, however, the co-writers aren't famous. Jorge Calderon, who we'll also talk about later in the week and who figures, you know, pretty prominently, in Warren Zevon's career, co-writes a couple of songs. And then Warren's friend Leroy P. Marinell co-writes Excitable Boy and Werewolves of London, the latter of which became a surprise hit single. And, you know, if you're over the age of – actually, I think even if you're under the age of, you know, 12, you've heard Werewolves of London. The song is ubiquitous. And it's that rare thing where it's kind of a novelty song, but it's also a great song at the same time. So, let's listen to Excitable Boy, the title track. That song's got it all. It's got a great piano riff. It's got those doo-wop backing vocals. Yes. It's got rock and roll sax, which is really tough to pull off without being annoying.
Yep.
And you know, the lyrics, which describe a horrific crime, are like really memorable. And apparently what inspired this song was that Zevon went to Leroy P. Marinell's house for dinner, and Leroy served pot roast. And Warren, I guess, at some point during the evening asked why nobody asked him to play lead guitar on any of their records. And Leroy's response was, "You got some good ideas, but you get too excited." To which Warren responded, "I'm just an excitable boy." Oh. And then they wrote the song. And what I love about it is, like, you can see them having, like, you can picture them in Leroy's dining room having the greatest time in the world, like trading back these absurd lines. And, you know, the first verse, he goes to dinner in his Sunday best and then rubs the pot roast all over his chest. And then, you know, then he goes to the Clark Theater, he bites the usherette's leg. And then, you know, And then you get to like the horror, like the right. verse about Susie and the junior prom. Like that's horrible.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like ghastly, but somehow it's like such a zippy little song that you're just sort of humming along and rocking out. Yes. And then
it's like, wait, what? What?
Yeah.
What was that? Yeah.
Well, he's so casual about delivering that line right. with the doo-wop stuff in the background.
Right.
Yeah. And then my favorite part is after 10 long years, they let him out of the home, right. which is like the funniest, most absurd line in the song. Like, you get 10 years for like a ghastly, horrific crime like that. And clearly, he has not learned anything in that 10 years because he goes and digs up their grave and builds a cage with their bones.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I remember too, as I was saying, I think on the first show we did about getting into Z-Von, I remember, and I'm holding this up to the video, I remember looking at the inner sleeve of this and going, what the hell is this plate of vegetables with a handgun laying across it on the inner sleeve supposed to mean? It kind of said everything. It was puzzling, but at the same time, very appropriate.
Yeah, and doesn't he call it like Willy on the plate or Willy on a plate or something like that?
Something like that. Yeah.
I don't know what that is. Maybe that's like a William S. Burroughs reference or something. He was always really into handguns.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excitable Boy hits number 8 on the pop charts. Werewolves of London is number 21 on the Billboard singles. Mm-hmm. And what I love to imagine is when I was 10 and first getting into sort of listening to radio on my own, I would listen to Casey Kasem doing America's Top 40. Right? So, you know, Casey Kasem undoubtedly, like you can almost hear him like, and now we've got a big hit with Werewolves of London.
That's right. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not bad. And I'm sure he was like, by Warren Zevon.
Yeah. And who called in a long distance dedication for that one, though?
Yeah.
Find out. Yeah.
Exactly. So Zevon's got a hit record, but his life is in shambles. At this point, he's a full blown alcoholic, like a drink vodka all day, blackout, beat up your wife, and wreck cars alcoholic. So that sort of brings us to the next record, Bad Luck Streak in Dancing School, which comes out on Asylum in February of 1980. And the usual LA rock royalty play on it. And Bruce Springsteen actually co-writes the song Genie Needs a Shooter. And Bad Luck Streak in Dancing School is it's a pretty spotty record, you know, and that could be due to, you know, the personal problems that Zevon was having. You know, during the Asylum years, he was sort of torn between being a singer-songwriter and being a piano pounding rock and roll animal who shouted yeah a lot. Like there's a live album, Stand in the Fire, that came out where you sort of hear the rock and roll animal side where he's just sort of shouting and growling through most of it. So, you know, there's, and sort of the rock and roll animal side kind of won out on Bad Luck Streak and Dancing School as well. There's like too much hard rock on there, but there are also these weird sort of like classical string interludes. But there are, you know, there are a couple of great songs. And I think there's The Ballad of Bill Lee, which is a really sort of beautiful piano ballad that's written about the Major League Baseball pitcher, Bill Spaceman Lee.
Mm-hmm.
It also could sort of be written about Zevon himself. It starts with the line, you're supposed to sit on your ass and not at stupid things. Man, that's hard to do. I mean, I just love that. And then, Wild Age and Empty Handed Heart are both great songs. But I think my favorite song on this record is Gorilla, You're a Desperado. So why don't we listen to that one?
BMW left me here to take
desperado. He built a house on an acre of land. He called it Villa Gorilla. Now I hear he's getting divorced. Laying low at Lermitage, of course.
So, you know, unfortunately, that song is marred by a really cheesy keyboard sound.
Yeah.
but, you know, it's still a great song. And on the one hand, it's sort of just a fun, goofy song about a guy who trades places with a gorilla. But it's also about, like, how miserable Zevon is. Mm. Like, you know, he's having a tremendous amount of success. But, you know, there's the line, you know, coming out of the break in the middle where he's like, then the ape grew very depressed, went through transactional analysis, plays racquetball and runs in the rain. Still, he's shackled to a platinum chain. And, you know, before that, there's a reference to getting divorced. I mean, it's all about how sort of bad his life is when it should really be looking up. You know, it's – I like it because it's sort of disguised as something kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he did that really well. It same thing kind of, you know, with Excitable Boy, in the sense that, like, it sounds like a happy song, but
yeah,
it's not so much, yeah.
Yeah.
And also filled with great lines. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, like, one of the most arresting first lines of a song ever is on this record, Grandpa Pissed His Pants Again. Like, that's a line where you hear that line and you're like, okay, I want to see what the rest of this is going to be.
Where's his head?
That's right. Yeah.
It's also got the cattle all have brucellosis, which I think that was David Letterman's favorite line.
Right. Like, gotta be the only appearance of that word in the history of rock and roll, for sure.
So the interesting thing about this record is it's dedicated to Ken Miller. That's Miller with an A, which is the real name of Ross McDonald, who is a celebrated detective novelist. And, you know, what's interesting, Zevon at the time he recorded this album, he was living in Santa Barbara and he was a big McDonald fan. So he sought out Ross McDonald and became friends with him. I mean, you know, Zevon was a guy with literary aspirations, but he wasn't a pretender. Like, you know, Ross McDonald, who was a lot older than he was, hung out with him and was friends with him. And writers, like serious writers, have gravitated towards Zevon over the course of his career. Like, you know, they really respected him because, again, he's a great writer. He doesn't work in sort of the novel form, but as a songwriter, it's really literary. So anyway, this album hits number 20 on the Billboard charts, but does not go gold. So I suspect it was one of those things where it was a big push. Like, you remember him from the hit Excitable Boy. He's back with a new record. And then when people actually heard the new record and weren't that wild about it. So and at sort of about the same time, Zevon's friend Paul Nelson, who is a noted rock and roll journalist and also I think – managed the New York Dolls at some point in the 70s. Anyway, Paul Nelson writes a cover story about Zevon. It's the cover story in Rolling Stone, the March 19th, 1981 issue. It's called The Crack Up and Resurrection of Warren Zevon. And you can read it online. And it's sort of, it's a legendary article with people of a certain age. And I think it's probably because, you know, to this point, there weren't really many honest portrayals of famous people's struggles with alcohol and drug addiction. I mean, the Don Reese article, which I remember reading as a kid in Sports Illustrated, like, that didn't come out till June of 82. So I think this was sort of remarkable in how open Zevon was about his problems and how troubled he was. You know, I've read the article. It's a little breathless, and Nelson could stand to be kind of a bit more removed from Zevon than he was.
Yeah.
But Nelson was also Warren's friend. So,
he was.
You know, he's,
I mean, he participates in an intervention in the article, if I remember correctly, right? Isn't that part of it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's sort of a horrific part in it where, you know, the cover to Excitable Boy, which is a photo that, and apparently Warren hated the photo because they got it all touched up because he looked like crap because he was an alcoholic. And so he looks kind of like a corpse. And at some point, Nelson talks about in the article how Warren's wife, Crystal, heard the gunshot, and she was terrified that he had shot himself, went running into the room, and he had shot the cover of Excitable Boy between the eyes.
Wow.
So it's, I mean, it's, the article is a vivid depiction of somebody who's really locked in a life and death struggle with alcoholism. And, you know, people like to have sort of a nice sort of bow put on things and have things wrapped up nicely. So the article comes out, Zevon's pronounced cured.
Yeah.
And that's the angle they use to promote his next record, The Envoy.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Zevon is not, in fact, cured, as we will talk about shortly. But, so The Envoy comes out in July of 1982. It's got the usual assortment of LA guest stars, including, it's got several guys from Toto on there. But they were also studio musicians. So if it's not clear if they're on there as guest stars or as dudes that are just like really great musicians.
Right, right.
And the author Thomas McGuain, who wrote 92 in the Shade, he co-wrote a song on there as well, called The Overdraft. And you know, The Envoy is a better record than Bad Luck Streak and Dancing School. The title track, by the way, is about Philip Habib, which, again, you know, is not someone that you would necessarily imagine would be immortalized in song by a rock and roll guy. So, you know, The Envoy has a couple of really great songs on it, one of which is The Hula Hula Boy, or one of which is Let Nothing Come Between You, which is a co-write with Jackson Brown, which is a really sort of touching love song. And then it's got this song about a guy who goes to Hawaii with his wife and gets cuckolded by the hotel staff. So why don't we listen to The Hula Hula Boys? That song, I haven't listened to in a while. That song is so amazing. It's
really is.
It's got that beautiful flute solo. It's got, I just love, like, I saw her leave the luau with the one who parked the cars and the fat one from the swimming pool. They were slaying arm in arm. But yet, it's fundamentally so sad. Like, right. A guy goes on a fancy Hawaiian vacation with his
terribly
wife.
Terribly sad. Yeah. It's heartbreaking.
And she takes up with the hotel staff.
Right.
Right.
So that song's got Zevon's 13-year-old son, Jordan, singing high harmony. Mm. And apparently, the Hawaiian words, the hyena, hia, maya, ana, kapuana, I think, that is Hawaiian for sing the chorus or get to the point.
Yeah.
And I think Jordan sang it because he was the only person that could pronounce pronounce the stuff. So anyway, the Envoy only makes it to number 93 on the charts, and Zevon does not release another album for 5 years, and the Envoy will languish out of print for like 25 years, which was like really frustrating to me when I was in the throes of my full-on Zevon obsession. Like, you just couldn't get the Envoy. At least, you know, I'm sure you could get a record, but I didn't have a record player at the time, so I was looking for it on CD, and it had never been released on CD.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Totally pre-streaming days too.
The frustrations of physical media back in the day. That's right. Yeah.
So that puts a wrap on Warren's Asylum years. So thank you guys for sticking with me. By my clock, I got us at about 51 minutes on that episode. So I trust that the faithful interns will do their usual excellent work and cut out my rambling.
It was all great stuff. So very good. Really Thank good. You for this. That was a great overview of that important period in his career, of course.
Absolutely.
But the story, I think, only gets more interesting as it goes, don't you think?
It really does. Yeah.
So you're not going to want to miss that.
Yeah.
You're going to want to listen.
Be sure to tune in.
That's right. Every day.
There you go. All right.
Yes.
If there were ever a week for everyday listening, this would be it.
Yeah. If you're not hooked already, folks, come on.
All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And I'm Hunter Bennett.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
I lay my head on the railroad tracks and wait for the double E. The railroad don't run no more. Poor, poor, pitiful me.
You guys have heard the Casey Kasem outtakes, right? Where he's notoriously foul-mouthed, right?
Yeah, I have heard some of those. They're really hilarious.
Yeah, they're amazing.